Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. For our first episode of 2021, we chat with renowned writer Jacqueline Woodson. She is the author of dozens of award-winning books for young adults, middle graders, and children. Among her many accolades, she is a four-time Newbery Honor winner, a four-time National Book Award finalist, and a two-time Coretta Scott King Award winner. This conversation took place September 7th, 2018, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. At that time, Woodson was the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. She is joined by AWM Program Committee member Sheila Murphy. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hi, Jacqueline.
Hey, Sheila.
I am so honored to be up here with you. Thank you again for joining us for an evening here at the American Writers Museum. And I know that many of your devoted readers are anxious to ask questions of you, but I thought we'd just start with a couple to kind of get us going. You are such a prolific writer, and you've just published two books simultaneously, the illustrated book for young children, The Day You Begin, and Harbor Me. Let's start with the Day You Begin. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you and kind of the theme that this book focuses on?
Yes, I'm going to tell you about it by reading a passage from Brown Girl Dreaming. And as Carrie told you, Brown Girl Dreaming is a memoir and is the story of me coming to be a writer. It'll be scary sometimes. My great-great-grandfather on my father's side was born free in Ohio, 1832. Built his home and farmed his land, then dug for coal when the farming wasn't enough. Fought hard in the war, his name in stone now on the Civil War Memorial. William J. Woodson, United States Colored Troops, Union Company B, 5th Regiment. A long time dead, but living still among the other soldiers on that monument in Washington, D.C. His son was sent to Nelsonville, lived with an aunt, William Woodson, the only brown boy in an all-white school. You'll face this in your life someday, my mother will tell us over and over again, a moment when you walk into a room and no one there is like you. It'll be scary sometimes, but think of William Woodson and you'll be all right. Thank you. So that poem obviously inspired The Day You Begin, the idea of what it means to walk in a room and feel like you're the only one like yourself in that room. So in The Day You Begin, I talk about the young people whose food is different from other people, who don't feel as athletic, who feel like the curl of their hair, the color of their skin, you know, the way the words flow from their mouths are things that separate them. And one thing that's so great is that when Rafael Lopez did the illustrations, he put rulers throughout the book to show how the kids were measuring themselves against other kids.
Okay. And a lot of those themes really inform Harbor Me. Do you think about, you know, the different ages of your audience as you develop themes and storylines?
I feel like all of my books are character-driven, so I have characters in my head first, and I tend to have a sense of how old they are. And then with the writing and the rewriting, my editor and publisher, Nancy Paulson, is here sitting in the front. And working with Nancy, asking me lots of questions and shaping. I tend to know if a book is going to be a middle grade picture book. I know when it's an adult book, like with Another Brooklyn, even though the characters in that book are 15, the person telling the story is looking back from her early 30s on that moment in time. So that makes it an adult narrative, where in Harbor Me, the kids are all in the 5th, 6th grade. So we know it's, and the person telling the story, Haley, is 12. So I know it's a book that I'm I'm using to speak to young people through. And picture books. My picture books tend to be more poetic, but very intentional and very immediate. So I know when you think of something like The Other Side, there will be times when that summer the fence that stretched to our town seemed bigger. We lived in a yellow house on one side of it, and white people lived on the other. And Mama said, "Don't climb over that fence when you play." She said it wasn't safe. So that's the first page of the book, and every line paints a picture. So I'm seeing it visually in my head, and in that respect, I know it's going to be a picture book. Except with something like Showay, I felt like with Showay, which is another family history, because it spans so many generations, and because of the internal rhyme scheme and the way it felt kind of a little bit older, I wasn't sure who it would who would be the person who came to the narrative. Same thing with Brown Girl Dreaming. I mean, I've gotten responses from 80-year-old white men and 10-year-old black girls and, you know, everyone. I think it's because it starts in 1963 and so many people have lived through so many moments in that book, including the young people who are living through them now.
Right, right. Poetry is present in everything you write, and mm-hmm. you seem to be really breaking down any silos that people might think exist between genres, or at least blurring them in terms of prose and poetry and mm-hmm. even memoir, fiction, poetry. Is that, do you consider yourself a poet first?
No. It's interesting. I don't know. I consider myself someone who loves and has a deep respect of poetry. When I think of my friends who are poets, when I think of Nick Flynn and Marie Howe, Cornelia Seedy, Langston Hughes, I think Tracy K. Smith. Like, I think the way they approach poetry is very different than how I do. I think my work is very poetic, but I think that their work, they have more of a sense of craft and depth of and the history of poetry than I tend to when I go to the narrative. But I am trying to limb the lines between the two and kind of create, for me, because as a young person, poetry was such a kind of hidden language. It felt very opaque until I discovered writers like Nikki Giovanni and Langston Hughes and County Color and you know, all the people of the Harlem Renaissance, and then later on, I feel like I want to do that with fiction. I want people to not be afraid of poetry. I don't want them to be afraid to approach poetry. And by writing in verse, by writing and being very intentional about white space and line breaks and all of that, I'm doing that.
Okay, great. Would you tell us a little bit about Harbor Me for people who have not had the joy, the pleasure of reading it yet, the themes that...
Can I read from...
Yes, okay. Please.
So Harbor Me is the story of six kids who are in a class with a teacher, Miss Laverne, and they're in this class, they learn differently. And so one day Miss Laverne says to them, she takes them down the hall to a room that they rename the art room, room to talk. And Miss Laverne says to them, "I'm going to take you to this room and I'm going to leave you here for an hour every day without any adult supervision. And I just want you to talk to each other." So this is from chapter 13. And the person telling the story is Haley. Think about the familiar. Every morning you get up, you brush your teeth and wash your face and put on the clothes you'll be wearing that day. Days roll into weeks and weeks turn into months. The leaves start falling from the trees. A wind comes up from the north and makes you shiver so hard your teeth chatter. Every morning you eat breakfast at school with your friends. You tear into the bagels and slurp up cereal and side-eye the suspicious-looking eggs. You and your friends laugh over silly stuff. Thiago Santa hat with the white beard attached, and the silly faces he makes whenever he wears it. Amari's drawings of dogs with wings, cats with crutches, impossible ice cream sundaes like wishes on paper. Think about what you know, how the mornings always come too quickly, and the weekends don't last long enough. how your uncle has always shaved the left side of his face before the right, for good luck, for habit, from habit, the familiar. The trips to Malone, Taco Tuesday, stories at night, hair day at Holly's house, the familiar. A lady with a tiny black dog leaves her building every morning, just as you're leaving yours, and she waves and you wave, but that's the only time you've ever seen her. We knew what we knew. We did what we had always done. Then one day, Miss Laverne said, "Put down your pencils and come with me." We left our classroom and walked down the hall to the art room. The familiar popped like a bubble above our heads, but we held tight to our knapsacks and kept on walking. So it's about these six kids and what they discover. And the book opens with the line, "I think they took my papi," and it's Esteban's story, which is the through line of the book of his father going missing and then us eventually finding out what happened to his dad. And then Esteban begins, his dad, when he finally figures out where he is, that, and the dad reconnects with the family, starts sending him poetry in Spanish because he wanted to be a poet as a young person.
One of the main characters, Amari, comes into the art room one day and announces, "The great imperfect world continues to spin on a slant." Mm-hmm. And can you tell us about sort of your thinking as a writer, you know, that line? I mean, that just kind of knocked me off my chair.
Oh, thanks. I think young people are really smart. And I think sometimes we don't understand how grounded and connected to the world and everything around it they are. And Amari's a kid who has just been told by his dad that he's not allowed to play with guns in public anymore. And he's African American. His best friend is Ashton, who's a white kid, and Ashton is like, you know, "Your dad's being stupid," basically. And it's about them beginning to understand the different experiences. But Amari is a really thoughtful and smart kid who knows what's going on. And I think that's the moment when he realizes that he wants to do stuff. He wants to sit on his dad's lap. He wants to hug his dad. He wants to still be a kid, but the society is saying, nope, this is the age you are, and this is what you're supposed to be doing at that age, and his sense of loss around that.
Right. Each of the characters' backstories, you know, seem to have to do with freedom, and they mm-hmm. really talk amongst themselves. I mean, they kind of recognize that as their, you know, empowering theme very early on.
Mm-hmm.
How, as you travel around the country and meet with so many different audiences, how do particularly young people kind of resonate to that theme? Or
They just reinforce it, that they're in that place where they're thinking about ideas of freedom, not only for their individual selves, but the bigger world, right? What does it mean to be free in America in 2018? What does it mean to be free in your caregiver's house? What does it mean to be free walking through this world in a brown body, in a female body, in an underserved body? And so I think young people, they don't have the language for it yet, but these are things they're thinking about. What does it mean to walk through the world in a quote-unquote privileged body and not know that body is privileged? So putting Ashton and Amari and Holly and Haley and Esteban and Thiago in the room. Thiago's Puerto Rican, and his mom is a monolingual Spanish speaker. And they, you know, get called upon for speaking Spanish in the street, which silences her. And, you know, people telling him that this is America, and he's like, "We are American. We're from Puerto Rico," and people just not even knowing the geography of our country, like,
right.
And that kind of craziness. Whereas Esteban is from Santo Domingo, and his dad gets deported, and so here are two people who share some parts of a culture, and one is much safer than the other in some ways in this country. You know, Thiago's not afraid of his mom getting deported, but he's afraid of her getting bullied because of her native tongue.
Right, right. And these kids are so smart that they put it together that they are not just connected to one another in the world in the present, but mm-hmm. that we all come from a lineage. Mm-hmm. And they've absorbed what they've been taught in school. For example, that, you know, New York City, New York State, originally was the home of the Lenape Indians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when people came and took that away from them, they couldn't believe it was happening either.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And the kids are still mad about it. Like, once they learn about the Lenape and the fact that they're, you know, walking on the souls of people who the land had been stolen from, it makes them feel some kind of way, right? Like, and then, of course, Miss Laverne, who's this great teacher, constantly challenged them to think about what that means. Well, if that history wasn't the history, would you be here? How would you be here? And what does that mean in kind of showing up and acknowledging, you know, even that kind of privilege, right? And what does the history of who we are, how does it make us behave today? And what are we going to do with that?
Okay, great. Is there another passage you'd like to share?
So this is when Esteban really connects for when he finds out about his dad. The first time we saw Esteban smile, really smile again, was in December. It was because of poetry. The Thursday night before, he had gotten a letter from his father, who was still in Florida at the detention center. At least he's still in this country, Esteban said, even though he's far away. And he's okay, I said. Okay-ish, Holly said. But that's better than nothing, right? Esteban had come down from the windowsill and was sitting with us in the circle. He unfolded the letter from his father. It was written on yellow legal pad paper. Esteban handled it delicately as we all leaned in to look at it with him. His father's handwriting was small and careful, each letter so clear it almost looked tight. He wrote me a poem, Esteban said. He said he has time to write now. He said when he writes, it's like he's back in the apartment with us. Nobody can touch it, he said. We all put our hands down in our laps. Even Holly lowered her needles. She's a knitter. That's cool with me, Amari said. Me too, I said. But can you read it to us at least? It's in Spanish, Esteban said. But I wrote an English version too, because one day I'm going to be his translator. You guys know what that is, right? We nodded, but Esteban was so excited he explained anyway. I'm going to rewrite all his poems in English for him, and we're going to sell books in the DR and in America. Then Esteban cleared his throat and read, when they came for me, I lifted my hands to them, let them wrap the cuffs around my wrist. I did not fight. I did not yell. When they pressed me into the van, there were others who spoke our language. A language of sun and ocean and beauty, a language of birds and merengue. We leaned across the van toward each other and knew the same people back home. Always remember, when you are with your people, you are home.
That's great.
Thanks.
You've worked with a number of national organizations. I know you've been active with the National Book Foundation, teaching mm-hmm. in their summer writing program. You were the Young People's Poet Laureate for the National Poetry Foundation.
Right here
last year, right
Chicago.
Here in Chicago. And most recently, Dr. Hayden at the Library of Congress has appointed you the ambassador for young people's literature.
That's what I put on my shirt. Yes. I don't wear it that often because the ribbon clashes with my outfits usually.
Can you tell us a little bit about your role?
as national ambassador. Yes. Basically, it's to go around the country and spread the gospel of reading and literature and the importance of gathering and having conversations that are deep and sometimes hard and sometimes scary, but that books help us to have. And so my platform is Reading Equals Hope Times Change. And I'm going into juvenile detention centers. I'm going into underserved communities, underserved schools. I'm going into community centers and any way where I can get people to gather and just begin to talk and use the literature as kind of the platform. So we're talking about different writers, we're talking about me, we're talking about books that people have read historically, and really thinking about all kinds of reading, not just, you know, I didn't struggle. I read slower than other people as a young person. And so I read differently. And at that time, it was not okay to be a slow reader. I mean, even today, it feels like people get challenged for reading slowly, and which I completely disagree with. I think people should read slowly because it takes us a long time to write these books. But I think part of it is remembering that picture books are for everyone, that you can use them at the high school level to teach poetry, and that you know, that there are all kinds of ways we read. My son listens to audiobooks all the time, and always has a book in his ear. And the great, I don't know if you can get this for free, but at the end, I think we're going to try to figure a way to do this, but at the end of Harbor Me, in the audiobook, my daughter plays the role of Holly. I play the role of Miss Laverne. We have different actors playing the other kids. And my son wanted to play a role, but he reads differently and kind of couldn't do it. So at the end of the book, he and I just went into the studio and had a conversation. And it's this really great conversation. When I first listened to it after it was recorded, it just brought tears to my eyes, because just how much he thinks about and knows, from, you know, him talking about Holly being racist, or Haley being racist against the Lenape people, to, you know, gender non-binary people. I mean, like, he just really goes in and talks about the importance of saying parent and parent instead of mother and father and all of these different things. But we talk a lot about literature and writers and audio books and picture books, and that's a lot of what I'm doing as ambassador. So I think he's been listening.
That's right. Wonderful. Well, one of the themes of the American Writers Museum, for those of you who may be on your first visit here, is that, you know, American literature is rich and diverse in many different ways, including all the, you know, not just the genres of poetry, fiction, nonfiction, but, you know, graphic novels, comic books, etc. And you actually introduce that very late in Harbor Me. You know, the Black Panther comic series and superheroes and superpowers. Is that something that you're interested in?
I'm interested in any way that people read. And I think graphic novels are amazing. I mean, I think that when I remember the resistance against them, right? It's like, that's not really reading. Those aren't books. So, yeah, you could read that, but you have to read something else. But I'm so excited that going from that time when there was resistance in classrooms and libraries to people recognizing that some people read this way. And so there have been all these graphic books that are nonfiction, that are for adults, for young people, that are about superheroes, that are realistic fiction. I mean, when you look at books like El Defo, when you look at books like Kindred, like just when you look at books like the Black Panther series that Ta-Nehisi Coates did, I mean, there's really interesting stuff going on.
That's great. Good. Well, before we open it up for questions, is there anything else you'd like to share with us from one of your books?
Should I read from Harper Me, A Brown Girl Dreaming? I'll read from Brown Girl Dreaming. This is my grandfather. So I always talk about my grandfather. So for those of you who haven't read Brown Girl Dreaming, I was born in Ohio. Then I moved to South Carolina when my mom and dad separated. Then from South Carolina, we moved to New York City, where I live now, as part of the Great Migration, where people came, you know, here to Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, New Jersey, to get away from the really oppressive conditions of the South. And when we were living in South Carolina, we lived with my grandmother and my grandfather, and I was my grandfather's favorite. And I always talk about how during that period, adults were allowed to tell their kids which one was their favorite. And you can't do that anymore. You have to say, I love you all the same. And for the young people, we're lying. So... Someday, you know, people always ask me what my favorite book is, and I say that, like, my kids, you know, I like one a little bit better sometimes, but mostly I love them the same. So this is called Tobacco. And my grandfather passed away when I was around 7. Summer is over, a kiss of chill in the southern air. We see the dim orange of my grandfather's cigarette as he makes his way down the darkening road. Hear his evening greetings and the coughing that follows them. Not enough breath left now to sing, so I sing for him in my head where only I can hear. Where will the wedding supper be? Way down yonder in a hollow tree. The old people used to say a pinch of dirt in the mouth can tell tobacco's story. What crops are ready for picking? What needs to be left to grow? What soil is rich enough for planting in the patches of land that need a year of rest? I do not know yet how sometimes the earth makes a promise it can never keep. Tobacco fields lay fallow, crops picked clean. My grandfather coughs again, and the earth waits for what and who it will get in return. And this last one I'll read is called Music. So, I grew up Jehovah's Witness, and I also grew up Muslim, because I think my family thought there wasn't enough religion in the house. So my uncle had been incarcerated, and when he came back from prison, he had joined the Nation of Islam, and then from Nation of Islam, he became more involved in the religion. So because he lived with us, we also practice the religion. So, I mean, I held stuff from both religions. I still don't eat pork. I'm scared of it because he scared me. You know, so much of that childhood thing was fear tactics. And they worked for me. But I celebrate every single holiday. I'm making up for the holidays I didn't get to celebrate. But I think the great thing about growing up in a religious family is you do learn how to be bored. So, you know, you get a lot of...
How to spend bored time collectively.
Yes, exactly. Bored time collectively. So this is called Music. So one of the things, we have very, very little TV. And last month, the month before, I did a story in Vanity Fair about Lena Waithe, who's from Chicago. And she's phenomenal. She's the one who did The Shy and, you know, is in Ready Player One and just has done all this stuff. But she was allowed to watch as much television as she wanted as a kid. And her mom said, as long as you don't repeat what you hear or do what you see on the screen. And I have very limited television and was made to read a lot. I spent a lot of time with books. And so, you know, she grew up to be this phenomenal TV writer and actor, and I grew up to be a writer. But so this is called Music. So we were allowed very limited TV, and also our music was very controlled. And I grew up in the 70s. Each morning, the radio comes on at 7 o'clock. Sometimes it's Michael Jackson singing that ABC is as easy as 1, 2, 3. Or Sly and the Family Stone thanking us for letting them be themselves. Sometimes it's slower music, the 5 stair steps telling us that things are going to get easier. Or the Holly singing, he ain't heavy, he's my brother. So on we go. My mother lets us choose what music we want to listen to, as long as the word funk doesn't appear anywhere in the song. But the summer I am 10, funk is in every single song that comes on the cool black radio stations. So our mother makes us listen to the white ones. all afternoon, corny people sing about Colorado, about everything being beautiful, about how we've only just begun. My sister falls in love with the singers, but I sneak off to Maria's house, where safe inside her room with the pink shag carpet and bunk beds, we can comb our doll's hair and sing along when the Ohio players say he's the funkiest worm in the world. We can dance the funky chicken, tell imaginary intruders to get the funk out of our faces, say the words so hard and so loud and so many times, it becomes something different to us. Something so silly we laugh just thinking about it. Funky, 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 we sing again and again, until the word is just a sound, not connected to anything, good or bad, right or wrong. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, hear from another acclaimed writer of young people's literature, Gary Paulson. The author of Hatchet and other wilderness survival stories shares his own story of survival in this heart-wrenching middle-grade memoir, Gone to the Woods. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.